Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome Sean Eisenhower to the Rooted in Reliability podcast. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks, James.
Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Sean, Sean specializes in adult education, change management, leadership, asset management, and maintenance reliability programs. Sean, you're a founding partner of Iridicio. You know, you're an active member in SMRP, been past chairman of the board, and I know you're involved in a director role in a couple different capacities with that as well. So thank you for assisting with that great organization.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a kind of a great organization for me. I've learned a lot through the years by working with them. So it's definitely a two-way street when you work with organizations like SMRP.
Absolutely. You've been involved in maintenance reliability for a long time, but on your personal time, you're a pilot. So you're living reliability every single day because you definitely can't have those sorts of issues when you're up in the air.
Absolutely. You can never pull over at 4,000 feet. So every time you leave, it's got to return just the way you want it to. So you really think long and hard about those pre-flight checks and really making sure that you're going to be able to do it's going to be able to do what you want it to do while you're in the air.
Absolutely. Now, that was a very brief bio. Can you fill in any blanks and provide some information on Iridicio?
Certainly. Well, just to kind of give you a little background on me, I came out of ExxonMobil probably 15, 20 years ago. After leaving ExxonMobil, I spent probably 10 or 15 years in international business consulting. So traveled and worked in about 49 different countries, spending time really focused on implementing reliability improvement as a whole. So that's my background, and as we go, I may use a few examples from some of those clients in the past. Now, as far as Iridicio, we are an education company, as you said. We focus specifically on applications. So everything that we're doing, we're trying to drive the application of that knowledge in the real world upon completion of whatever curriculum or course that the individual is going through. So I think we'll probably hit on bits and pieces of that as we go through the morning, but that's a big focus for us because without that application, you can't get the return on investment.
Absolutely. Knowledge is nothing without execution. So how did you get started in maintenance and reliability, first off?
Well, back years and years ago, my father is and was a diesel mechanic. So when I was old enough to hold a wrench, I was definitely old enough to work. Apparently, child labor laws don't apply to your own children. So with that said, that was my early start. I started to note some things. I probably did most of the opposite of precision maintenance in many cases over the early part of my career. But because of that, I got a bit interested in it and went on to engineering school and then decided to focus specifically on the maintenance reliability side of engineering.
There's a common background to people who get into maintenance reliability. They were either taking apart things as kids, their parents worked in some sort of trade. There seems to be some sort of common background of being involved, working with your hands, trying to understand stuff at an early age. So it's very interesting to me that those subtle things when you're younger can make those huge impacts on your life.
Yeah, I think you hit a good point. It's amazing, you know, when I talk to folks on a regular basis that are in the engineering and maintenance roles, you hear, you know, common things. You hear about Legos. You hear about taking apart the lawnmower. You're exactly right. It's amazing how just those little things early on can make a really big difference.
Absolutely. Now, you were involved in maintenance reliability in a consulting piece, so obviously that involves some training. It involves some coaching, some mentoring, and some direct implementation. But what caused you with Iridicio to focus specifically on the education, training, and application of maintenance reliability topics?
Well, I think the big thing for us was, you know, having been there and done it over the years, we really wanted to see if we could create a way that people could do it themselves. And it really comes back to the ownership piece. And not every consultant or consulting organization is this way, but, you know, in general, there are quite a few organizations out there that come in and they do great work for a client and they get really good results. But as soon as they go away, because it was a consultant-owned implementation, so does those good results. So we really wanted to focus specifically on developing the skills within a facility such that they could implement and sustain their own improvements.
That's a great point. I've seen that occur in many organizations when I was working as within that business and dealing with consultants. It truly does have to be owned by the organization, the people within that organization. Without that, it's not sustainable. And, you know, the approach I take, which is very aligned with yours, is you build the capability, you leave them better than you return so they can sustain that stuff moving forward on their own. Yes, they may need help from time to time, but they need to own it. They need to drive it. If not, the business benefits will not be there in the long run.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So with that and that ownership of the training, the application of that knowledge, can organizations develop and implement their own training programs and ensure that application?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very possible for an organization to develop their own training programs. There are a few key things that I think are important in order to do that. One of the things that really comes to mind for me is, you know, while you may be really passionate about the subject, for instance, it could be reliability, but are you passionate about education? And that's a struggle, I think, for some organizations. They just don't have that internal competency around adult education. But if there is interest within your organization to do that and set it up and be focused and drive it forward, then absolutely you can set it up within your own area.
Now, not trying to become adult education experts, can you give us the top two or three things that people should consider when developing that training program for adults?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of the big hitters or the things that we see on a regular basis, you want to make sure that you're driving application. You want to make sure that the information that you're conveying is tailored to the roles and responsibilities of the individual. And those, just in those two, you can probably think back to past training that you've experienced, or I know that I experienced when I was in industry, where someone's implementing a CMMS or an EAM, and the idea of training is a 3-day class for everyone. Now, I may be in a maintenance engineering role, or I may be in a maintenance supervisor role. Those are two completely different roles with two completely different set of requirements within that CMMS or that EAM. So by tailoring the training and then making me apply it in the software, that's going to drive that retention. And then, of course, reinforcing it by making it part of our business goals.
Absolutely. You touched on some great points. I often get asked, can you do a plan scheduling course for an organization? And so I'll ask the question, well, who's going to be in it? And you'll get, well, the planner, the schedulers, okay? We'll get the supervisors. We'll get the maintenance management. We'll get some production supervisors. And we'll get some operators. So you can pretty much cover everyone in one shot, and it'll be fine. Well, no, you can't. Let's focus on the specific requirements of that role each time to make sure it's effective. You put a production supervisor in there. Yeah, they have to submit work requests. They have to provide certain information. But are we going to tie them up for 3 days when they only need that 30-minute intro to and delivery?
I think you're right. I think it really comes down to understanding what the real roles are that the individual is trying to fill. And I know you know this, one of the ways that we identify those are through mapping the business processes. If you understand the business process and you understand where the responsibility lies within that business process, you can start to map the training deliverables to that level.
Absolutely. The unfortunate part is a lot of the organizations that I've been working with lately don't have mapped business processes. They don't have RACI charts. They don't have any of that stuff. So we almost have to develop that first before we do the training.
Yes, that is very common for us as well. So I think we are definitely seeing the same thing. And you know, a lot of people don't think of doing business process maps and RACIs as necessarily fun things to do. I think I've gotten to the point where I really enjoy them, as sick as that may be. But, you know, it's an interesting process because as you go through that with those individuals, you really start to see the learning happening before you ever get in the classroom.
you start to see them realize that, well, the way they're doing it today has multiple paths and broken links and issues galore that they've never really sat down and thought about.
Yeah, absolutely. And then they start to realize why it doesn't work, why the kitting process is falling apart and it's a struggle to make anything work. That enlightenment it's awesome when you see that.
I think at the end of the day, that's probably why a lot of us teach, is for those light bulb moments where we see, you know, someone realize something that they've always done or always thought may or may not be exactly the way it is.
Exactly. It's true. I just did a course on planning and scheduling, and this one planner for first day, well, no, planners don't have to get up from a desk. No, they don't have to go scope. So did some exercises with some Legos, and the light bulb moment went of, this is why I actually have to go see what's going on out there and write a job plan. And then he went out and actually scoped those simple job as part of an exercise within that course. And he read it back and it was phenomenal. It's like, that's exactly what we need to be doing. And it clicked. You could see him understand why playing with Legos, why having a job plan was so important.
Yeah, James, I call those pretty pants planners. They're the planners that can wear the nice pants to the office because there's no chance they're going to be on the floor doing any work.
Exactly.
If they're not willing to get out there and look at the job and see, you know, what issues and constraints may be in play, those job plans that they create just don't have a lot of value. And I think you saw, and he saw, that transition from, wow, you know, what I used to do to what I could do if I got up out of the, you know, out from behind the desk.
Yeah, it was a huge light bulb moment for him and everyone else in the room. So it was fantastic. Now, training is so vitally important to making that change and moving along that journey in maintenance and reliability. Now, there's a lot of different training providers out there. So how does an organization go about selecting a good training provider, getting the best value for the money, and actually ensuring that that stuff will be applied in their organization?
Well, I think, you know, one thing you definitely want to look for is experience and understanding what you were trying to do. But I mean, everyone probably, you know, goes out and looks for that. But the next thing that I think is important is a training provider that listens to what you need, not provides a course off of their shelf. And what I mean is, they want to, you know, if your training provider just says, oh yeah, I have this course, here it is, then that may not be the right training provider for you, because what's the chances that the course that they've created is really exactly what you need? So from my perspective, you know, one of the things that I would want to see is I would want to see that training provider asking me, what are the learning objectives? What do you want to see these people do differently when they come out the other side? And then tailoring that training specifically to, as we just talked about earlier, kind of the RASIs and the processes that you're driving forward. I think the third thing that I would want to see if I were looking is a training organization that wants to drive not just completion of training exercise, but that application piece. And it reminds me, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the ProSci model, and ProSci talks about an acronym called ADCAR, Awareness, Desire, Knowledge, Ability, and Reinforcement. And when you think about that, training drives a lot of that change process. Training can provide awareness. Training can show them what's in it for them to create the desire. Training obviously is about providing the knowledge. And then that application is about them demonstrating the ability. And then hopefully the organization is then going to put processes and leadership in place in order to reinforce it moving forward.
Yes, absolutely. That model is fantastic when you understand it. I use it in almost everything I try and do because of that, the way it structures that. Having the knowledge isn't the ability to do it. It's that application piece that's so important. So good to see that that is being used. And I think that reinforcement piece is so important. It requires the line manager of the person taking the training to follow up. Did you do this? Did you apply this? And that's why it's so important to have those learning objectives identified up front, so you can refer back to those. Did you achieve this? Did you do this? And having that little push, I think, is what drives people to implement and create that ability.
Well, and I think, you know, to take it a step further, you mentioned, you know, their supervisors or their leaders, you know, having that leader be educated enough to know what the right questions are to ask. More often than not, I run into leaders in organizations who have very light levels of understanding of the concepts that are being taught to their subordinates. And that can lead to them asking the wrong questions or not driving the right reinforcement.
Absolutely. So that leads me to the next question I have is, what pre-work should a student or attendee be doing ahead of that training course to, one, improve their retention and to improve the effectiveness of that training?
Well, for us, this is where we've used a technique or a methodology that came out of the elementary education world, and it's called the flipped classroom. And the idea behind it is we take a lot of what would traditionally have been lecture or long, uninteractive sections of the content, and we flip that into an e-learning environment and provide that out to the students in advance. Whether you're going through one of our classes or whether you're going through someone else's, any of that content that covers basic processes, vocabulary, how it all fits together, those are the kind of things that we definitely want to get out in front. Because now, when you get into the quote-unquote classroom, now you're getting to apply what you learned with someone who really understands it. And if you think about how this, how and where this came from, you know, out of the elementary education system, one of the issues that they were facing was the fact that the students would get a lecture from the teacher at school, and then they would go home to their parents, and their parents didn't know how to do algebra any better than they did. So they had a very poor coach in that scenario. So they flipped the classroom, they put the lecture out as homework, and then the students were now completing the quote-unquote homework in the classroom with a coach that could really help them and lower that frustration level. And that's, I think, you know, from an education standpoint, I think that's something that we can all do, is what can we get out that is in that basic level that people can take a look at and spend some time with prior to engaging in the classroom.
Absolutely. That's a great model. And having that time to go through with that coach to troubleshoot, to understand, to really dig into those topics, I think is vital. Now with that, what can students do to increase their retention during that coaching and mentoring piece? Is there anything they can do they want to be conscious of ahead of time?
You know, I think there's a lot of things they can do, but I'll give you a couple of just really simple ones, I think, from my perspective. These sound kind of crazy, but they really do make a difference. One in particular is don't doodle. So if you're in the training session and it does go lecture for a few minutes or it does go into a discussion that is not an interactive activity, just, you know, step away from that desire to start drawing boxes and squares and coloring in things on your notebook. Because depending on the study that you look at from an adult education standpoint, when folks start drawing and doodling, that retention level drops significantly. Now, one of the things that we recommend is something called fiddle toys, and this can be, you know, anything from a stretchy ball to jacks to, you know, just a little cheap toy laying on the table. But by picking up that toy and playing with it and using that to focus your energy on instead of picking up that pencil and starting to doodle, that also is a great way to keep from doodling and keep that retention up so that you take more of that content back with you.
That's an interesting trick. I've never heard of that. So definitely, I'm going to steal that one from you, I'll be honest. So, you know, I'm sure the instructor also plays a huge role in the ability of that retention, the delivery of the content, all those other aspects that go into this. So what makes a great instructor? What should companies be looking for, not only in their training, but at the instructor?
So we've found that instructors and coaches are two different things, and we may get to talk about that a little more as we go forward. But for us, the keys for the instructor is the ability to have passion about the content. I don't believe, at least not right now in my career, I don't believe you can fake passion. And I think the students pick up on it very quickly. And so, you know, you see a lot of really, really smart people that are in instruction roles that unfortunately just don't have a lot of passion for it anymore. And because of that, they can be incredible subject matter experts and really pathetic educators. So, you know, passion, I think, would be first for me. I think, you know, secondly, they have to have not just a passion for the subject, but also a passion for education, a passion for trying new things and trying to find out how to best convey the material. And so, you know, you're looking for that on both sides. Now, that's completely different than what you want for a coach. And we can talk more about that later.
Perfect. Excellent. Because we are going to get to that because I know how important it is in the application and reinforcement piece. So we have that great instructor. We have that great training course. We've talked about, you know, making sure we have an understanding of the learning objectives. So it's going to be applied. Those learnings will be applied in real life. What else can organizations do to make sure the application of the learning takes place?
Well, I think one of the things that all of us, and this would be listeners who are both practitioners as well as listeners who are out there delivering. But, you know, I think one of the key things that we've got to do is we've got to educate the leadership. And I don't mean, like we talked about earlier, I don't mean putting them through the exact same class necessarily, because that doesn't meet their goals and their needs and their time constraints. But I think we have to get our leaders, I say past the curve or past the danger zone. And that comes from a study that was done in the aviation industry that basically said, as a pilot passes 200 hours, from 200 to 800 flight hours, they're the most dangerous pilot that you can fly with. And the reason is they believe they've got this. They believe that they understand it, and they do things that they really don't have the skill to recover from. In my life, you know, as you mentioned, I am a pilot. I fly helicopters and airplanes. And as I think back, this is, you know, that young pilot who decides that chasing cows with a helicopter is a good idea, or that young pilot that takes the plane and decides that they can go under high tension power lines over a lake. You know, we joke about it, especially in some of my southern facilities. We joke about it. It's kind of the old, hey, Bubba, watch this, you know, and then whatever happens, right?
Yep.
So we see that in the leadership too. Because, you know, picture it, you know, you're a leader in the organization, you're focused on a lot of other things. You might not be focused on root cause analysis or planning and scheduling or whatever the case may be, or may have not had any dealings with it in years. And yet you're expected to coach individuals that report to you in those areas. So a lot of our leaders live in that danger zone. And, you know, I think it's key for us to make sure that even though they may fight it, we're educating them to the level that they need to be so that they can be successful leaders of people in that discipline.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Once they're aware of what needs to be done, there's an old saying, what's important to my boss is important to me. So once they're on board, have that understanding, they're going to ask the right questions to drive those behaviors. So couldn't agree more.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So how important is coaching and mentoring in that education and learning process? Now, we've touched on it a bit, but I want to make sure people get an understanding of how important it is in the application and reinforcement portion of that training process.
Well, and I think for us, it's absolutely critical. You know, the coaching and mentoring piece is where we drive, as you said, the application and the reinforcement. If someone's not doing that, if you're just sending people out for training classes and expecting them to come back and apply it on their own, and they're not getting either one of those key pieces of the change process, then I would say that you're wasting your training budget. I've seen it for years. I lived it in my past life, you know, where we would send someone out for a public training class and they would come back and quite frankly, they didn't do anything different. So there is no real return. And, you know, so I think it's absolutely critical whether you as a leader within your organization are the coach and the mentor, or whether you're having someone else do it, there needs to be someone in that role if you want to successfully make change with your training efforts.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the question is, and you alluded to it earlier, what makes a great coach or mentor, and how often should they be catching up, be involved with that mentee, I guess?
Well, and it, you know, let's start kind of first with, you know, what makes a great mentor. a great mentor is not necessarily a great instructor. And we've seen this for sure as we've grown our company. Some of our best instructors are not our best coaches, and they'll openly tell you that. And some of our best coaches aren't our best instructors by any stretch because, you know, quite honestly, the instructor is kind of putting on a show. We call it edutainment. They've got to keep engagement up. They've got to keep activities going. They are kind of, if you think back to the circus, they're that ringmaster that's keeping everything going during that training session. That is not what a coach does. You know, a coach is there to empathize with the student and think of different ways to explain a concept such that the student can relate to it. To be able to work with that student without that student feeling like they're asking dumb questions. And that's it's a completely different personality. And those are some of the key things that I think a coach needs to be able to do. You can be a great subject matter expert. You can be one of the best in the industry. But if you can't relate to the subjects and they feel like you're challenging them at every turn, then they can't effectively use you as a coach.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com. Once we've identified who is a good coach, who is the good instructor, and we've separated those, and we're using our coach, how often should they be touching base? Is it once a day, once a week? Does it depend on the topic and the application process?
It really depends on the topic. It depends on the topic and the maturity in the topic. So we have quite a few curriculums that we work with students for a year to 18 months. Our reliability engineering and maintenance engineering curriculums typically run around 12 months. So we're engaging with that student, you know, for an extended period of time. In doing that, we're going to be very engaged and be in contact with them a lot in the early stages, because in the early stages, they're kind of trying to figure out how this fits in their environment and how they're going to use the education that they're getting and how they're going to change their organization. So there's going to be a lot more questions and a lot more things to be addressed. Whereas as you get to that later side, they understand a lot more. And at that point, they're just bouncing ideas and making sure that they're still on the right path. So it's highly variable, and it really depends on the subject, and it depends on the maturity.
And I'm sure the individual plays a huge role in that as well. Some people are very motivated, driven, want to understand, want to drive, and some aren't as driven. So I'm sure that plays into the level of coaching required as well.
Well, I think that plays into it. And I think another thing that we see just on a style standpoint, there are some that would prefer coaching via email. There are some that would prefer coaching verbally. So that mentor or that coach has got to begin to understand how they like their coaching and meet that as well. And that's going to dictate how often and how much.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I have to ask this question, and you mentioned a little bit of it earlier, and we're going to switch paces a little bit here, but I believe there's a lot of misunderstanding around e-learning, that it's not effective, it's not engaging. So, in your opinion, can e-learning be engaging, and is it a viable form of training?
It's a great question, and I would agree with you. I mean, I'm a product of the late 90s e-learning boom. And so, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I certainly remember sitting down behind training videos and knowing that if I hit enter 17 times and then enter the letters ACDC and hit return, I'm done. You know, safety training, compliance training. It was just an act of getting through an automated PowerPoint slide deck that someone had put some questions at the end, and that was considered e-learning.
Yes.
That's not the world anymore. It's truly a different environment. When we go into e-learning now, we develop a lot of our e-learning in-house. We have hundreds of e-learning modules at this point that we use for our custom our custom educational offerings. And when we think about those e-learning modules, we're thinking about, you know, what are those same thing as earlier? What are the learning objectives? How can we get them to apply that learning objective in a safe virtual world? And then what can we do to send them out of the e-learning to go out into the real world and apply it there as well? So if you were to go through some of our content, what you would see is we might introduce someone to a subject, let's say walking down assets for setting up your CMMS system. We'll introduce them to what the criteria are for what some of the key elements that they need to collect is. And then we give them a three-dimensional environment, and they can interact with this 3D environment in the e-learning module or through augmented reality. And in that environment now, it's safe. No one's making fun of them. No one's judging about the way they do it. But they're able to go into that environment. They're able to find the nameplates on these pieces of equipment. They're able to collect that nameplate data and bring it back. So it's truly a different level. It's almost blurring the lines between traditional face-to-face and e-learning. Then, of course, what we would challenge them with next is, okay, now you've done it in a safe environment. You know what it looks like. You know what you need. Now let's go do it out in a part of your plant.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge piece there. The automated PowerPoint doesn't work. It's not effective. And like you said, people can just fast forward, hit click, they're done. Fast forward, click, they're done. They can do through that to get through it. Making sure it's interactive, making sure it's applicable to what they actually do in real life, and trying, like you exactly said, making it that safe environment where they can try things, fail. So they build that confidence and that ability is, I think, one of the huge advantages to e-learning as well.
Well, and I would say, you know, one thing that we didn't talk about that we probably should is it ought to be fun. It shouldn't be drudgery to sit down and go through the e-learning module. You know, when I think back to those older modules that we had years ago, it was 30 or 45 minutes of dread and agony. Whereas today, our modules will be shorter in length. They will be more varied in path, meaning different students will go down different directions depending on the choices they make. And it's going to be fun. There's funny things that happen within our e-learning content to kind of keep it lively and keep it more upbeat.
Yes, absolutely. That requires a tremendous amount of thought through and preparation ahead of time. And also having people that are developing the content know something about the topic that they're developing that around. So that's why I'm assuming you have an in-house group that does a lot of this for you.
We had to. We didn't see any other way possible as we started building out our e-learning curriculums. You know, you can spend a lot of time trying to explain to a graphics designer or an e-learning designer what the inside of a motor looks like and how it rotates. And then you get it back and the wrong part's rotating. So we learned very quickly that we needed to keep an in-house staff of developers that could help us develop content and that could learn the basics of maintenance and reliability so that they don't have, you know, those technical glitches that you see in some e-learning.
Yep, absolutely. Now, if you had to choose e-learning in person, how would you do that? What are the pros and cons with each?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think you can choose. We don't believe that it's one or the other. In fact, you'll hear us talk about our IBL product or our Inspired Blended Learning. And what that really means is we've mixed both of those together. We've got that in-person face-to-face training that we use as a kickoff because there are, as I'm getting ready to list for you, a lot of pros and cons around that. On the flip side, the e-learning, it gives us content and it gives us standard content delivered the same way with a consistent message. So, you know, there's pros and cons on both sides. You can't beat working with a coach or an instructor in the classroom and putting your hands on a component or putting your hands on a piece of equipment or working through the backlog for a planning and scheduling class. You just can't beat that. I mean, there's just a lot of value in being able to ask questions and point at things. So we believe you need that, but we also love the fact that if we use e-learning, we can get a standardized message out to literally hundreds of associates, hundreds of employees, because that's one of the issues you face with just using traditional face-to-face training is that it depends on the instructor. It depends on his background, his stories, where he's been, what he's seen. I can give you two completely different classes with the same material depending on, you know, what instructor I put up there.
Yeah, absolutely. The standardized message, the ability to scale that out is one huge advantage to e-learning. But like you said, being able to ask questions, touch, feel things is also vitally important. So having that blended approach, I believe, as you mentioned already, is the right way to do things. It's just making sure that it's structured in a way that they complement each other.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to complement each other. And you know, let's put it all together. I mean, we talked about face-to-face training and we talked about e-learning. And I think that coaching piece that we talked about earlier really comes into play as well. You know, having someone that you can call anytime and ask them a question as you're going through and talking with someone on the floor or trying to implement one of the solutions, you know, that's blended learning. That's having all of it at your disposal such that you can be more effective in whatever your role is.
Absolutely. Now, going back to that coach or mentor, is that coach or mentor someone specific, or can anyone be a coach or mentor, or is it reserved for people with a specific title? Are there informal coaches and mentors that we can leverage from the shop floor level, or do they have to be designated maintenance coach or mentor?
Well, and I think, you know, I think it kind of depends on how structured you want your program to be. I know personally, as I was growing up, you know, in the industry, I had a lot of coaches and mentors that were very informal. You know, it was something that I was seeking out. It was something that I was going after to find them. I think about one in particular in the machine shop. I learned an incredible amount about machining parts and components from that individual. Now, he didn't have the mentor title. You know, he was simply an individual who took an interest in the machine shop. And there is absolutely no reason that that can't occur. But what I will tell you, in an educational setting where I am trying to build curriculum, that has to be a lot more defined. Because if I leave it up to the student to go find a mentor, then there's a pretty good chance that may not happen. So while almost anyone can be a mentor, given the right skills and the patience and the desire to do it, it does need to be a little more structured in order to build a true blended educational process.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You can use the informals, but you need to have that structured approach to make sure everyone's getting the same level of coaching. We're reinforcing the same applications and all those various things. Now, we're getting close to the end, and I use a similar set of questions for everyone towards the end of the conversation. But what specific tips or words of wisdom do you have or would want to share with people who are looking for training? Something small, simple they can look at using right away.
Okay. So I think for me, the first thing I would say is application, application, application. Don't let the student leave the classroom without a plan for how they're going to apply it when they return. I think that is absolutely critical. So if I left the podcast with nothing else, have a plan more than just a list. Have a plan that you're going to execute when you get back to apply what you've learned. I think it's key.
Yeah, absolutely. Take the learnings and apply them right away and make sure you have those milestones set up with that application. Perfect. Now, what is the one thing you see done incorrectly commonly with maintenance and reliability training that you would love to fix if you had a magic wand?
Oh, man, if I had a magic wand, I would go directly after one specific thing right out of the gate. It's something that drives me absolutely nuts, both as a student, and I sat through one of these just recently as a student, and, you know, as someone who has been asked to convey education, and that is the 350 PowerPoint deck. 350 slides for 2 days or 350 slides for 1 day. It just needs to go away. To me, if it takes you 350 slides to cover the content, either you as an instructor are not very comfortable with the content that you're teaching, or you've got an issue with the way you're teaching it, because I don't know too many students that can absorb that level of content when you're hitting them with rapid fire PowerPoint.
Yeah, being able to relate it, make it relatable to content, having students link the applications to it is important. It's funny, I've sat through those same things, and generally I don't find them that effective, But there's the occasional instructor I found who was able to pull that off and still make the training effective, but the majority can't. It's way too long. Yeah. It's dry. It's difficult to follow.
That's a good point, but I'll make another point here. I think it depends on the instructor. I think it depends on the student. And what I mean is, if you're a student that has just really gotten into whatever that topic is, and you're in those early stages of discovery, you know, the nerdy students, the ones who are reading all the magazines and reading all the books, I think you can learn from almost anything. But if I'm going to go out and convey that messaging to a group that maybe is not as engaged or as excited as that beginner level person is, then you as an instructor have got to be really on your game. But the other thing, if there's 350 slides, when did you have time for application exercises? When did you have time to get people comfortable using these things in the classroom environment?
Yep. Once again, it goes back to that application piece, right? Making sure we apply Absolutely. It and we understand it. Now, for the listeners who are going to attend training in the near future, whether it's at a conference, whether it's they're going away to a public course, or there's a private course coming to them, what is the one thing you want them to do differently when they sit through this next training session?
The one thing I think they should do differently is, of course, as I mentioned earlier, don't doodle. Stay focused, stay engaged. Make sure you're really working through the exercises in the class and ask that instructor questions. You know, have you seen this? What happens if this happens? All those things that you think in your head but sometimes are a little nervous to ask, get those questions up there and get them out front. If the instructor doesn't have the answer, they can always get back with you a little later as they reach out. But that is your opportunity in many cases, because if you're at, you know, say a conference or you're at a public course, you're probably not going to see that guy again in your facility. So really take that opportunity and seize it.
Yep, very good. Create that connection. Learn as much as you can from them. And the one thing I found, too, that works well, especially in public courses, make the connections to the people in the course. So if you're working through applying some of that, you can reach out to them and ask, hey, did you try applying this? What did you learn? So you can create that informal social learning. And I find that's hugely effective in driving that application and the retention of that knowledge.
Yes, that's a great point. Half the value, if not more, of coming to a public class is the fact that you get to network with those individuals. We have a lot of clients, especially for, you know, the reliability engineering, maintenance engineering, planning and scheduling curriculums. They want to keep it just their company. And that it almost every time starts out that way. And then eventually the door gets a little crack in it and a couple people from other plants get into one of their classes. And then by the end of every single one of our engagements, they actually want others from other facilities in there because it's amazing what they learn from each other. So I couldn't agree more.
Perfect. Now, we're going to focus these last two questions specifically on you. So where can people find out more about you? What events, activities are coming up that you're involved with? You know, Where are you going to be in the maintenance, reliability, and adult education world?
Very good. Well, I've got a pretty busy schedule coming up, so I'll give you a couple ways that you can find out a little more about what's going on. First of all, my blog is reliabilitynow.com, and you can check that out, and I'll put some information up there occasionally. Our Iridicio website, and I'll spell that out for everyone because I know it's a little tough. It's Eruditio.com. We try to keep information up there as well. But if you really want to find out where we're traveling to, what conferences we're attending, the best way by far is LinkedIn and definitely Twitter. So on Twitter, I go by my full name. It's at @SHONISENHOUR. And on LinkedIn, of course, it's Sean Eisenhower as well. We do keep everything we're doing there, so you can kind of follow us, see what we're doing, see what crazy new videos we put out or what funny new content we've released.
Yeah, you guys do a great job at some of those interesting videos, whether it's your Super Bowl videos you put out about the consultants, the Star Wars ones you've done. You know, they're quite entertaining and good, so I do enjoy those.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we just firmly believe that it doesn't have to be boring. It can be fun.
Absolutely. And with that, is there any resources you want to share with our listeners?
You know, I think the best way to get to our resources is probably going to the iridicio.com website blog. You can click on the blog link. We're in the process of reworking our website, so you'll see that change just a bit over the next few months. But that's one place. And then the Reliability Now blog as well. On the Reliability Now blog, there is probably around 200, 215 blog posts. So there's a lot of content there. You can scroll down to the word cloud toward the bottom of the page and click on specific topics that you're interested in. But we've got everything on there from, you know, how to set up a good training class, how to coach, how to solve problems using root cause analysis, how to use a torque wrench as an example from a precision maintenance technique standpoint. So there's just a lot of good small bite-sized chunks of content there that folks can take a look at.
Perfect. I know I've visited both those resources, so I can attest to the value and quality that you guys bring with those things. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Thank you. No, that's very much likewise. We enjoy what you're doing, both with your information like what we're doing today, but also with all the tweets and action that you do in the social scene, which is great, because I think, you know, especially the younger audience, it really likes their content in that manner. And I think, you know, if we can deliver it, that's good for everyone.
Absolutely. Well, Sean, it's Saturday morning. I don't want to keep you all Saturday morning, although I'm sure we could go on this stuff. So thank you for taking the time to walk through this topic with our listeners. I know it's a topic that needs to be talked about. Everyone spends money on training. Everybody wants training, but majority of companies don't seem to get the value from it. So I think you touched on some very great points that hopefully organizations will make the right selection up front and then get the value from their training as a result of some of the things we talked about today.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. And if anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'd be more than happy to field questions and see if I can point you to specific resources for specific issues that you're facing.
Perfect. And I'll make sure all the links and resources you mentioned are set up in the show notes with links, so we'll make it easy for them to reach out to you.
That sounds great. Thank you.
All right. With that, Sean, thanks and have a great morning.
Thank you.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.